Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Hi there. Former Democratic Senator Bill Bradley of New Jersey is with us, the Rhodes Scholar and presidential primary candidate against Al Gore in 2000, has a new book called We Can All Do Better. We will also talk about the thing about him, that very rare history that he shares with Jeremy Lin, coming out of an Ivy League college to become a star on the Knicks. Senator Bradley, it's always a pleasure, and it's been a few years. Welcome back to WNYC.
Thank you, Brian. It's always good to be with you.
That's a very communitarian title you've got there, We Can All Do Better. I think most people are writing us and them political books these days, saying they can do better, no matter who they are. Why We Can All Do Better?
Well, it comes from Lincoln's second State of the Union address. The country's at war for about a year. It's not going well for the North. It's before the Emancipation Proclamation. And Lincoln sends this address to the Congress, and it is an incredible document. And in it, he says, among other things, we can only succeed by concert. It's not can any of us imagine better, but can we all do better? And I thought that question, can we all do better, was relevant to the inequality and fragility of our economy, to the direction of our foreign policy, to the paralysis of our national debate, and to our own lives. I mean, can we all do better? Can we find that part of ourselves that is selfless and honor it? Can we take care of our health better by watch what we eat, et cetera? Can we learn more if we're in school, or continue to learn if we're finished and just living a life? And so it implies that there are a lot of things. There are clearly the national questions. Can we do better? Can we improve our economy? Can we make middle-income people with higher incomes? Can we deal with the deficit? So there are big issues there, too, but that's the thought behind it.
Do you think there's kind of a Republican, Democrat, or liberal, conservative sort of, you know, tribal difference in what kinds of book titles people choose to contrast with our guest from last hour, Arthur Brooks from AEI, The Road to Freedom? And he warns that our individual lives are going to be turned into serfdom if we keep going down the path that we are with big government. Yours, a lot of Democratic books are We Can All Do Better. You know, we all have to pull together. It's almost like Democrats want to talk about sacrifice and Republicans want to talk about individual rights.
Well, I'm not really talking about sacrifice. I'm talking about self-realization, really. And if you take the point you've just made about individual rights or Republicans and Democrats, you know, a lot of people in your audience, I'm sure, have seen the that great NASA picture from space. That's, you know, the Earth out there in the blackness. Well, you can't look at that and not realize that we have one global ecology, and yet our politics has become basically a battle between two competing ethics, the ethic of responsibility, individual action associated with Republicans, the ethic of caring, collective action associated with Democrats. And that's what the debate is, and that's clearly what you pointed out in the contrast of the two titles of the books. But the reality is that if we're going to deal with our challenges and problems in the 21st century, we need both. We need both individual responsibility and collective caring. I mean, you know, we need to have health care for everybody in the country. But the more you take care of your own body and the healthier you are, the less you're going to cost the whole system. We need to have Social Security solid for retiring generations to come. But if you want a really good retirement, you're going to have to save some too. And so what I'm basically saying here is that the challenges we face depend on each of us doing our best. And yet even at our best, our fate as individuals depend on our national community. And there's no way around that.
Former Senator Bill Bradley, his new book is called We Can All Do Better. We can take your phone calls for him on anything in the book, anything from his career, 212-433-WNYC. 212-433-9692, and we'll get to your thoughts on Tea Party versus Occupy, your thoughts on the place of a possible third party in American politics. I'm curious to have you look back for a minute on your presidential race, to which you devoted 3 years of your life. The difference between Bush and Gore turned out to be so stark that people forget about the earlier differences between Bradley and Gore. How do you look back on your reason for running that race?
Well, I feel it was a great privilege. I think anyone who runs for president of the United States can be engaged in something that will be a memory for the rest of their lives and has the possibility, if you win, of helping change the country. And I was very fortunate to have that opportunity. I believe that, you know, you find when you're out there that people look at you a little differently because you're a candidate. They project their hopes, their dreams, their fears, their angers on you because they think, you know, the president is someone who can actually help make my life better. And I think that's true. And so it was a remarkable experience.
But you, I think, were trying to point out real cleavages in the Democratic Party. For example, in this book, you're really pretty critical of President Clinton for what you call muffling the Democrats' moral vision while conservatives kept hammering away at big government in moral terms during Clinton's second term, especially in the late 90s. How do you look back on the Clinton record?
Well, I think the Clinton record was excellent. I think that he took a very serious big decision on deficit reduction when he came in. He passed the NAFTA. He passed the WTO. He set the groundwork in his early years for the prosperity of the 90s. My point that I was making there was that when we had the Republican resurgence, he tacked to the middle, and maybe that was the only thing that he could have done. But when he said in, I think, a State of the Union that essentially government was the problem or
the era of big government is over.
The era of big government is over or whatever. He was essentially, and all the commentators said, well, it's just like Ronald Reagan. And the point is that that's probably what he had to do in order to win. And I'm better that he be there than a Republican. However, the fact is that unless you have a moral language, Republicans always use a moral language of right and wrong. I mean, your previous guest, right? And Democrats use a policy language. And in a battle between policy language and moral language usually wins. And the Democratic moral language has to go with taking care of everybody in this country, with making sure that we fulfill our obligations to other people, that government has a role in our lives, that indeed government is the agent of much of the strength of America because it is a collective expression in our best sense.
Of our democracy. But it's funny. Maybe both parties always feel that they're on the defensive and the other side's politics are always getting over on theirs. But Arthur Brooks last hour said exactly the opposite. He said, Democrats are so good at making the moral case. They're always talking in terms of fairness. And Republicans keep falling back on these wonky arguments like tax cuts are going to be good for the economy when they need to make the case in moral terms, which is what he tries to do in your book. But it's really funny because I should play the two clips of you and him together saying literally the exact same thing about the other. How do you see President Obama in those terms, though?
I think President Obama has probably the most difficult job since Franklin Roosevelt when he came to office. I mean, the financial crisis was in free fall. The economy was headed down. Unemployment was going up. We were in two wars. He stabilized the situation and has moved it forward now. And I think he should be applauded for that. But, you know, on that in 2008, on that election night in Chicago, I think we made a mistake to believe that a leader could renew the country by himself. Even somebody who touched our hearts as deeply as Barack Obama can't do it alone. I mean, a leader can lay out with clarity what the direction, but he needs lieutenants and sergeants. He needs citizens. He needs citizen commitment in the fullest sense of the word. And, you know, absent that, things are not going to happen. For example, you look at every are many major changes we've had in this country's history. And they came from citizens' movements, not from an idea of a senator or a congressman or even a president. I mean, somebody had to say slavery is immoral. That was the abolitionists. Somebody had to say women had a right to vote. That was the suffragists. Somebody said we ought to perfect our Constitution and our laws for, so African Americans can have a full life. That was the civil rights workers. Somebody had to say we shouldn't have clean air and we should have clean air and clean water, not polluted. That was the environmentalists. Each one of those things started with a movement of citizens.
So who failed in the last 3 years? Because there was this huge movement of young people of color, of others, even Wall Street, that had coalesced around Barack Obama. So did Obama fail to then lead the movement that had coalesced around him? Or did other leaders, potential leaders from the private sector, fail to come forward?
I think that Obama laid a clear direction of where he wanted to go. His whole campaign said, you know, elect me, we can change Washington, we can do great things again as Americans. And then when he got to Washington, he found he was entering another world, another culture, in which the role of big money is determinative. And absent citizen involvement, moneyed interest control. And let's just take 2009, 2010. During that period of time, the financial industry contributed $315 million to politicians in Washington in those 2 years. The healthcare industry, $145 million. The energy industry, $75 million. So it shouldn't be a surprise that financial reform was watered down. He wanted a stronger reform. It shouldn't be surprising that there was no public option to private health insurance. He wanted a public option. And that there wasn't even an energy bill at a time where, as your previous guest would talk about, energy is a crisis. And there are answers. And yet, you know, money entered this picture. And to me, this is a structural question. It's like the way we draw congressional district lines to maximize one party's advantage over another. You know, when we have money in politics and congressional gerrymandering that reward the extremes, if you're in a 60-40 district, you don't need to worry about election. You are really worried about primary challenge from your left or from your right. And so you don't come to the middle and negotiate things that are important for the country as a whole. So I think that, you know, the polarization that is fostered by the way we draw congressional district lines, combined with the role of money in politics, would make it difficult for any president to get his full agenda done.
Is that letting him off the hook too much?
No, I think that, you know, if I were he, and I argued at the time, his first act should have been public financing of elections. He had 70% approval rating. He probably could have passed it. If he had done that, these other issues, financial reform, healthcare, energy, whatever, would have been much easier to accomplish, because then the congressmen and senators wouldn't have to be milking the special interest to finance their campaigns, but the taxpayers could have financed it for them. And for $3 billion a year out of a $3.5 trillion budget, you could have taken the special interest totally out of politics.
So when we come back after a break, we'll find out why Bill Bradley is not a total fan of the Occupy movement, what role he thinks a third party could yet play in American politics. We'll talk a little Knicks and Jeremy Lin. We'll take your phone calls for Bill Bradley right after the break. His new book is called We Can All Do Better, 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692, or you can post your question to WNYC.org. Click on Brian Lehrer Show. Brian Lehrer on WNYC with former New Jersey Senator Bill Bradley, his new book, We Can All Do Better. And David in Manhattan, you're on WNYC. Hello.
Hi. Senator Bradley used a very interesting phrase, self-realization, and which has also spiritual connotations. And I was wondering if he could expand on that, especially because he used the word, you know, the earth as one.
Sure. One of the chapters in We Can All Do Better is a chapter called Celebrating Selflessness. And in that, I talk about the people that I interview on my radio show, American Voices on Sirius XM Satellite Radio, in which I interview people who are doing extraordinary things in their community, such as the guy that shined shoes at the Pittsburgh Children's Hospital for 46 years. And out of every tip, he'd put a portion of that tip into a fund to pay for poor kids' health care. And the day I interviewed him, he'd put over $100,000 into that fund. These are the kind of stories that I think reflect the goodness of the American people. And in terms of us getting better, certainly meaning as a country, we have to deal with our problems. As individuals, we, you know, I think we find that part of ourselves, and we all have that part of ourselves that is selfless and honor that, because that is the best of ourselves, in my view. And I think that in the context of our times, that it also holds a clue for what we need for economic revitalization. It will be teams that will actually determine the future, not just individuals working in a hierarchy, but teams of teams. And so that selflessness plays a very real role. And, you know, I was a basketball player, and you're only 1 point on a 5-pointed star if you're on a championship team. And so these are relevances, and I agree with you. I think there is a spiritual dimension to the things I'm writing about in We Can All Do Better.
Your court mate on the Knicks, Phil Jackson, was into that kind of thing. When he became a coach, he, you know, he became famous for being sort of into Zen and self-realization. Are you sort of a Zen guy?
No, I'm not. I mean, Zen is fine, you know. I think that I do yoga. I do that for about an hour a day or hour and a half. That helps my back.
Mike in Jersey City, you're on WNYC with Bill Bradley. Hello.
Yeah, Senator Bradley, it's an honor.
Thank you.
There was a joke that the right sort of lost use of after the communist defeat in the Cold War that used to go that the difference between a liberal and a communist was that a communist knew what he was doing. And the point of the joke was to suggest that liberal policies, you know, nobody questions that they're well-intentioned. All right. The question is whether they're practical and whether they really work. And if somebody from the right listening to this kind of talk, there's this implicit assumption that these programs are effective and, in fact, have made things better. And the usual fallback was to cite Medicare and Medicaid and Social Security as incontrovertible proof that these liberal policies are wonderful things. And while I think the previous guest's point that you must always have a safety net is absolutely right, we're getting to a point now where those big three are representing the biggest financial threats to the solvency of the country. So isn't it time for the left to sort of, assume the burden of proof again and demonstrate that their programs actually work, not that they're just simply well-intended?
Sure. I don't think you're saying that we should repeal Social Security or Medicare. I don't think you're saying that. If you are, I disagree with that. I think that we can modify them because of the cost. For example, I remember back in 1983 when Social Security was on the brink of bankruptcy at that time, and there was a commission, a presidential bipartisan commission. Those were the days, right? Established to try to deal with this. Well, I represented New Jersey, and
we have them again, by the way, but nobody adopts their recommendations.
Right.
But go ahead.
And I wanted to figure out what my constituents thought about this. So I had a professor from Rutgers who went around with me for 10 or 12 different meetings, and he put up on the blackboard the options. And the political assumption was that anybody who was working would like to solve this problem by cutting the benefits of the elderly. And the assumption was the elderly would like to solve the problem by raising the taxes of individuals, and that neither of them, would like to increase the retirement age. I found something quite different in those town meetings. I found that people who were working were also sons and daughters of grandparents who were on Social Security. They didn't want their grandparents to take the sole hit. And I found also that the grandparents were also grandfathers and grandmothers of working people, and they didn't want them to take the hit fully with the tax increase. And both of them thought that if it was far enough off, Yes, you could gradually raise the retirement age so people could prepare for it. It wouldn't be abrupt. And that is precisely what the commission did. And the result was Social Security is solid for another 40, 50 years, 60 years. Well, we're at that point again, and we need to reevaluate programs. And Social Security is not a difficult problem to solve if there was a willingness to deal on a bipartisan basis with the subject. On the questioner's other points about the government and pointing out Medicare, Medicaid, Social Security, I'd say, no, just kind of think of your daily life. You drive through the tunnel to get to New York. That's a government expenditure. You go to the pharmacist and get some drugs. That is through the FDA. That's approved that these are safe. You turn on the weather every day. That's the weather department that does that. That's government. You'd want to know where oil is in America. You go to Geological Survey. They're the ones that have mapped it. So government is all around us, and it lays the foundation for a lot of economic growth. And one of the things I say in this budget, in this book, we can all do better, is that we need to reinvest in infrastructure in this country, which would be government investment that lay the foundation for the 21st century.
You went to work on Wall Street after your presidential run in 2000. You've actually been working in venture capital, investment banking, things like that the last 12 years, haven't you?
Yes, I have.
Some people would say, gosh, why that of all things for somebody who's so values-based? Did Bill Bradley go to the dark side?
Well, you know, my father was a small-town banker, so maybe that had some impact. It was okay. It wasn't going to the dark side. And also, it gave me a good insight as to how decisions are made and how capital flows in our economy. I mean, you know, if you start a company, you need capital. And if you start the company that is a new thorium cycle, right, well, you know, you've improved the health, the welfare of the public.
Does that perspective of your work the last 12 years give you a certain perspective on the European debt crisis and whether, as Arthur Brooks was saying last hour, that really is a cautionary tale for where we might be in this country if we don't trim government soon?
I think that's a little exaggerated. I do think that you can't have deficits that extend to the horizon. And I point out in the book, I tell the story of how Rome ended up with Caesar to deal with the debt problem, how France ended up with Napoleon to deal with the debt problem, and how that contrasted with the United States in its first 10, 15 years. I mean, you know, Washington was president, Hamilton was the Treasury Secretary, Jefferson was the state Secretary of State. Hamilton tried to solve the problem of states that had gone into debt. And the way he wanted to solve the problem so we'd have one national community was to have the federal government bail out the states, take on the state's debt. States like Virginia and Jefferson said, absolutely, we're never going to do this. We managed our debt. We don't have much debt. But the rest of the state, we're not going to bail out that spendthrift South Carolina or Massachusetts. And so there was a stalemate. And Washington said to his two cabinet members, solve this problem. You're both reasonable people. And so they negotiated, and couldn't get a deal. And finally, what Hamilton proposed was, would you agree to get the Virginia delegation to support the federal assumption of state debts if we move the national capital from New York to the banks of the Potomac? Jefferson said, you got a deal. And what is that an example of? That's an example of compromise, negotiation, and it lies at the core. And we dealt with our debt problem. And because we did, whenever there was a chance to buy the Louisiana Purchase, we paid for it because we were able to borrow money from people around the world and double the size of our country.
Betty in Monmouth County, you're on WNYC with Bill Bradley. Hello.
Yes. Firstly, I'm an old suffragette. But I wanted to know, I've never experienced such dichotomy as I have in Washington. There's nothing in the Constitution that says we have to have two parties. And I mean, we're all Americans, and can't we have our representatives representing all of us?
And you do have a third party proposal in your book, more for Congress than the presidency, right?
Yeah. I mean, I would say to Betty, I appreciate your commitment over all those years, and I hope you're happy with the results. Sometimes in American politics, there have been points of view that were irreconcilable. The period right before the Civil War, turns out. Other times, you know, it's resolved by political combat. Fierce, vicious, but not bloody. And one party wins dramatically. Or you have a period of bipartisanship, which were the years that I served in the Senate, where you could get things done because you negotiated across party line. And today we seem to be paralyzed. We're polarized and paralyzed. And so I'm saying if one party doesn't wipe the floor with the other one, obviously I'd prefer the Democrats to do that, and if the paralysis prevents one party or the other from making any compromises, then you set up a situation for a third party, which would be a third congressional party, not a presidential party, but a party that would come in with a very specific agenda, say a constitutional amendment on money in politics, say a specific deficit reduction package, say a very sizable infrastructure program. So, and they would be at the fulcrum of power and be able to negotiate and break this stalemate.
So what's your idea of a third party? Is it a Simpson-Bowles centrist party? Is it an Occupy party if you want a Citizens United constitutional amendment?
Well, if you're in between two extremes, the obvious place you want to be is in the middle to pull people from both extremes to the middle. And, you know, you ask about Occupy. Well, I mean, the Tea Party. Let's take Tea Party and Occupy. The Tea Party emerged very quickly, had one very clear objective, roll back government, and decided immediately to get involved in electoral politics. And in 2010, they elected 43 Tea Party members of Congress. And so when John Boehner, the Speaker, and President Obama agreed on a deficit reduction package in principle, and Boehner took that back to his caucus, the 43 Tea Party Republicans rejected it and brought the country to the brink of bankruptcy. The point is, that's how quickly things can change. Nobody heard of the Tea Party 3 years ago. Occupy, on the other hand, had a great slogan, which was "We're the 99%," and it pointed out a very serious problem, which is income inequality in the country. But it did not have a specific program. What is it that you want to have done? And it chose not to get involved in electoral politics, as Tea Party did. And therefore, it had no way to translate its passion to the levers, to control the levers of power. And I think back to the 1960s. I mean, you had Dr. Martin Luther King, whose moral force and dream and vision was the driving part of that period, but you needed a Lyndon Johnson who knew how to get things done and could manipulate the levers of power to achieve the dream, or partially the dream, that Dr. King laid out.
So Occupy needs a platform, according to Bill Bradley. His new book is We Can All Do Better. You have a few minutes left. Do you still follow the Knicks?
Sure. Once a Knick, always a Knick.
It is, you know, lost on nobody, I think, who follows the team, that you came out of Princeton onto the Knicks. Jeremy Lin came out of Harvard. Are you watching him with a certain identification?
Sure. I'd like to see him succeed. I think he's a good player. I think, you know, he had a good several games, 15 or 20 games with the Knicks. And I think he's probably 3 years away from his full potential. And I think he needs a team that moves without the ball and that is unselfish to maximize his opportunity and skill.
Does that mean he can't thrive in the shadow of Carmelo Anthony?
Well, I personally think that, you know, if the game slows down because one person has to have the ball and everybody's not moving, then you ask about Jeremy Lin, not Carmelo, but his potential will not be fully developed. And it's the old story. It's the old story. And I've said this for many years, you know. When it comes to the Knicks, the key is you have to draft and acquire character, not statistics. And if you draft statistics, somebody has 9 points on one team and 13 rebounds, they come to another team, you can't assume that's what's going to happen. It depends on the interaction among the players.
Do you think scouts missed Lin's ability, either because he's Asian or because he came from an Ivy League school, or both?
I think they missed his ability who knows why they missed his ability. I mean, you know, he was a good player at Harvard when he was there.
And in high school, and he didn't get recruited.
And he didn't get recruited. I think that, but you also have to recognize that in the last 18 months to 2 years, he has raised the level of his game dramatically. And that goes to his character. He's smart enough to know what has to happen to get it done. And he has got a good enough character. He's going to work very hard to make that happen. And that's why I think he could be a good player, really good player.
How much ribbing did you take in pro basketball, like Mr. Egghead or anything like that?
Not a whole lot. I mean, you know, I was – teammates, you know, they gave me the name of Dollar Bill because I had such a poor wardrobe they thought it would be an incentive for me to buy some new clothes. Or the other joke was that I could take my – wear my clothes and go through Central Park and nobody would mug me because they knew that I'd already – I looked like I'd already been mugged.
So, wait a minute. They're the ones who came out of the hoods. You're the one who came out of the preppy college, and you were the one who was getting ribbed for dressing down. Did your Ivy League background give you any competitive advantage on the court?
None. I mean, other than, you know, I'm the product of my parents and my education, and maybe it broadened my view of the world and my view of whatever I do in the world, including playing basketball.
Have you met Jeremy Lin?
I met him once. I went to this Time dinner the other night, and Rick Stengel, who's the editor of Time and who was an old dear friend of mine, was on this so-called red carpet, said, come on over, meet Jeremy Lin. And so I went over and said hello to Jeremy Lin. I mean, I hope he does well.
That's it? That's it? Do you have any advice for him based on your experience?
Just continue doing what he's doing and hope that he gets a team where people move without the ball.
Does Coach Woodson deserve a shot at the permanent job?
I don't make these judgments for the Knicks. I mean, I haven't watched him enough.
These are the things that Knicks fans are talking about as they hope that apparently or possibly with Lin back on the court on Wednesday night that they will be able to actually at least play one more game against the Heat in Madison Square Garden.
I just hope he doesn't hurt himself.
Yeah.
Coming back for one game, it's a pretty big risk.
Bill Bradley, former senator, former presidential candidate, former NBA player. His new book, We Can All Do Better. And if you want to meet Bill Bradley, you're going to have to mark this down on your calendar because it's not tonight, but on Monday, May 21st at 7 p.m., he will be at the Union Square Barnes & Noble. Are you going to read or are you just going to sign?
Charlie Rose is going to interview me.
Oh, no kidding. So that's great. Monday, May 21st, 7 p.m., Bill Bradley with Charlie Rose, Union Square, Barnes & Noble. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Brian. It's always a pleasure.
Brian Lehrer, WNYC. And coming up next, the changing place of being fat in African-American culture. Did you see that op-ed in the Sunday Times? We will talk to the author who is getting a lot of praise and a lot of pushback, and we will take your call. Stay with us.